little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all go to the university and they all get put in boxes, little boxes all the same. And there's doctors and there's lawyers and business executives and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martini dry, and they all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university, and they all get put in boxes, and they all come out the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family, and they all get put in boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
You're listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void. Recording the conversations of others and selling this work for a few dollars a week quickly became more than a moonlighting second job for me. Listening in secret is a peculiar form of voyeurism, as one's vantage is nearly that of the surgeon's. It is a strange fact of experience that listening to a recording of people conversing provides hints to their deepest inner natures, whereas simply bearing witness to that same conversation would as strongly bar such insight. The reason for this, I have realized, is that as one does not need to maintain one's own identity while secretly listening, there is a very clear and very intuitive absorption of information. But being oneself takes enormous energy, and one's attention in the company of others is usually on oneself. At any rate, Mr. Branson, my original contact with the stalwarts, continued to pay me for my recordings, despite their hit-and-miss value. He never told me who to record, but I did find myself receiving greater sums of money for recording persons of some importance, newspaper figures, local politicians, certain shopkeepers. But I was not swayed by the money. My main interest was my subjects themselves. Much in the way of the layman's self-congratulatory position on high art, I didn't know what I liked, but I knew what I liked when I saw it. At the cafe or out on the sidewalk, even up on stage, my eye continually discarded possible candidates. Him, her, that man, this lady, this couple. Until finally, I would find myself directly drawn, without possible turning away, toward a certain special someone. Here, I would think, is someone into whom I need to dive. and simply by recording them for a few hours and listening back, I would find myself deeply satisfied. "I know you," I would think. I discovered the Penbennies one afternoon, seated evenly across a park bench overlooking the Ashton River. Three middle-aged citizens, equally grey in the hair, a man and two women, possibly a brother and two sisters, possibly not. Hands on knees, rods stiff in the back and neck, very neatly but very plainly dressed. They would look bored if they were not so Victorianly ramrod. This gave them an odd bearing of being very fully but very peculiarly alive, as though each moment someone was waving sharp sniffing salts beneath their downturned noses. Their composed silence and shared stiff manners indicated that kind of murmuring brown osmosis of fused, joint personage. They had become ghosts of each other. I watched them from the distance, instantly knowing that I needed to record them. The gentleman, whose name I later learned was Bert, with minimal effort, checked his wristwatch every minute or so until I understood that their visit to the bench by the Ashton River was, of all things, a timed event. Whether by consensus, inherited history, or other domination, the Penbennies had somehow worked it out that exactly 10 minutes on the bench by the river would be an excellently good arrow to stow in the quiver of their shared life. Bert sat in the middle. To Bert's right was a slightly larger woman. This was Freddy. She wore a greenishly purple dress with small dirt-colored patches and a bland straw hat. Over the course of my experience with them, Freddy proved to be the least active of the Penbennies, which is saying a lot, as they were the most eerily unmoving people I have ever met. The woman on Bert's left was Caldonia, who had a slight twitch in one of her feet, which I took to be a symptom of her trying to keep as still as Bert and Freddy. Originally, it was Caldonia's left foot that shivered and popped, but the tremor later traveled to the right foot. Then later again, it shifted back. At Bert's urging, after the predetermined 10 minutes had passed, the Penbennies stood in goosey formation and strolled in single file with very light gait, arms not much in motion, knees brushing, with their too small and highly royal stride, up the brick path that chaptered slowly away from the river and seeded up into the main park where I daily relaxed between shows. I was doing Bodleian at the time at the Homer Marx Theatre in Toledo. I followed the Penbennies, pleased to observe them put forth a new installment in their wild adventures across the galaxy. They sat down, equidistant, a king and two queens, in the same rigid, hands-on-knees fashion, at the bench near the fountain. Another arrow for their quiver. Bert, quite admirably, continued to lightly supervise his watch. They sat for another 10 crystalline minutes, gazing at the white shooting froth emerging from the tweezing mouth of the granite dolphin in the memorial fountain. Or, not gazing at the white shooting froth. Who could know? Well, I wanted to, and desperately. Perhaps they were the Victorian stiff, drab salt smellers they appeared. Or perhaps theirs was the wildest of possible existences. My imagination ran the limit. They were royalty from another country. They were exotic criminals. They were aliens. They were brother and sisters. And they were lovers. I had no performance the following day, but showed up at the park nonetheless, camcorder at the ready in my shoulder pouch. I had obviously found my target. I had set a simple task: discover where they lived. Planting my camcorder inside their home was the ultimate goal, and I longed for an open window or unlocked door. These were days, remember, where a certain kind of person considered it bad form to lock a door, as though to think others capable of sin was itself a kind of sin. At any rate, as for myself, I was unconcerned about entering other people's homes or apartments. I enjoyed it, I thrilled to it, and I would do whatever it might take to get in, The Penbennies spent their afternoon wandering here and there, standing in certain places for certain lengths of time before soldiering off. I was a little disturbed by their severe regulation. It wasn't often that following or spying brought on any emotional reaction in me. I was usually quite cold, quite taken, and quite unannoyable. But the bothersome Penbenny same walking, same sitting, and obnoxious timekeeping was gnawing with tiny teeth at my nerves. To alleviate my growing upset, I took to imitation. As I followed and spied, I walked like them, small steps, knees brushing, royally slow. On a nearby bench, I sat like them, hands on knees, rigid back, as though smelling some powerful waking agent. As the afternoon wound down, the Penbennies stopped very briefly at a corner market for provisions. In my somewhat detached state, I was not surprised when I found the Penbennies turning down Windsor Street, my very own street, and therewith entering my own building, the White Cliffs. My lack of amazement continued as I followed them inside, where, of course, they entered the unlocked door of the apartment directly across from my own. I stood in a lingering half-stepping odd fashion at the top of the staircase, uncertain how to proceed. I had not occasion to experience so obtuse a situation yet in my life, such that I was both frozen to a pointed stillness while yet flash-burning for action. As one was home, in a way, it was hard to continue one's secret mission. Should I listen at the door, or simply step inside my own apartment and pick up whatever strand of my own existence? I went home and ate.
I know a couple of newlyweds, they've been newlyweds for years. Just a pair of spooners, sunny honeymooners. This happy couple lives next to me, and it's music to my ears. When after every kiss, I hear him saying this. Okay, toots, if you like me, like I like you, we know nobody new will do. It's okay, toots. Okay, toots, if you say yes, then I say yes, and if you say no, then it's no go. It's okay, toots. You know I'm in favor of whatever you do. I tasted the flavor of one kiss, and I knew it was okay, toots. If you wash dishes, I dry dishes, I dry dishes, I'm ambitious. Okay, toots.
I followed the Penbennies the following day to be certain of their schedule. They were by no means simple city wanderers. For the entire morning and up until exactly 2 o'clock, they stayed inside what I knew from my own apartment layout to be a small two-room space. From 2 o'clock to 5, they were out, sitting in their benches and doing their regally inclined bric-a-brac timed positionings. With their remarkably schedulized, Yet to my eyes, empty of real events, life, it was not especially terrifying for me to enter and wander around the Penbenny dwelling, which I did the following day. I had an afternoon performance, but I was able to return by 4 and had a free full hour to quietly ransack the Penbenny residence. As they were not door lockers, the door opened to my push, and I moved slowly in. My breath was taken. Had they moved out? The bare white linoleum floor was stood with a bare unpainted wood table, surrounded by 4 bare chairs. There were no books anywhere to be seen, no radio, no rugs, no decoration. One might call it thoroughgoing plainness, but it was more than that. There was absence here, intolerance, or so I thought. The highest regard was to that of emptiness. Bizarrely, I did finally discover a jigsaw puzzle in a box with a folded newspaper on top of it on the kitchen counter. The bedroom was 3 small beds with white coverings neatly made. In the closet was a single steamer trunk within which lay 3 piles, an extra full set of folded clothing for each of them. The refrigerator was empty except for that evening's dinner chicken and what I took to be a yam. On the kitchen table was a tall canister of water with 4 small glasses pressed against its base. I was struck by there being 4 glasses and 4 chairs, but couldn't pursue the thought. I had previously noted that the Penbenny routine included getting provisions at the corner market for the following day. Thus, breakfast and lunch would have been daily consumed by the 2 o'clock exit, with dinner alone ready for their return. Upon which return, they would very efficiently restock for the following day's 3 meals. The lack of sensible aliveness was disquieting, but it also made my task more difficult. I usually managed to discreet my care recorder in the rubble of my target's burgeoning clutter, in the jumble of a jammed closet, with the microphone corded out beneath the door and externally hidden behind books or in some greenery. But the Penbenny's nearly objectless world offered little in the way of hiding spots. Even the floors beneath the beds were shiningly exposed to the naked eye. You could simply and easily see everything in the apartment without effort. The newspaper, I had noted, was a few months old, and there was a whiff of dust on its faded headlines. The jigsaw puzzle was a little too small to hide the care recorder, and the box would not fully close when I checked its possible use. But it would have to do. I slid the microphone into the newspaper crease, set the care recorder to record, and went for the door. By my watch, I had 3 minutes to spare before the Penbenny's return. My hand was on the knob as I heard the solid percussive beat of 3 sets of same-hitting Penbenny footsteps in the hall. I checked my watch again as hot little pins of terror scratched my spine. Early. They were back early. My assumptions about the exactingness of their schedule were, perhaps, made too hastily. I backed into the empty shrine of the apartment, my own footsteps echoing off the unadorned walls. Obviously, I would not find safe harbor inside the apartment. I flew open the balcony window, stepped out on the ledge, stumbled over some odd chunk of building debris before managing to safely step from their possible view. This being the second floor, I felt relatively safe. Still, the right sort of fall could kill. I was safe, I thought, from pedestrian observation, as this was the alley side of the building. And, too, there was a thick drizzle falling, black drops in the oiled dark alley. The ledge I stood upon was pleasantly ample, and after a few minutes, I felt very safe adhering to the brick face. As I hadn't time to close it, the Penbenny window remained open. I superficially glanced at the object that had tripped me up on my initial exit. It was not, as I had thought, some kind of ledge debris, but, in fact, a large glass container, as might store some perishable pantry item. But this glass box was full of books, and not reading books, notebooks. A male arm shot out the Penbenny window, Bert's fingers clasped around the glass box of books and disappeared, pulling the window shut. The rain fell harder. I waited. Unable to commit to leaving, and after a few minutes of wondering what next, I decided upon a preliminary peek-in, after which I commanded myself I must hasten around to the backside of the building and make my way down the fire escape. As my eye barely cleared the pane, I saw Bert. He was sitting at the kitchen table, a glass of water in his left hand. On the table before him was an open notebook, and in his right hand, a pencil. He scribbled furiously. I leaned deeper. In the chair beside him, back to me, was Freddy. I could not see her physically writing, but when I saw Caldonia in the chair to the right in a mirror effort of Bert's, I knew that each was, as per usual, involved in group sameness. They were all writing. I watched this go on for a while. There was a pencil sharpener in the table center, and a few extra pencils spilled free from a box. Despite his furious writing, Bert also continued checking his watch, and after a period of time, he said something I could not hear, although I knew my care recorder could. They each placed their notebooks down on the table, stood, and then, in musical chairs formation, walked around the table 1 o'clock hour and took the next chair. The fourth chair had been removed from the table and set against a far wall so as not to disturb their movement. My first assumption was that they would now all read what each had written. But, to my rain-drenched astonishment, after a moment's perusal, they began to write, apparently picking up where the other had left off. I waited an hour or so on the ledge before the window reopened and the glass box with its 3 hard-bound notebooks, pencil box, and sharpener were discreted back into position. There was a reason I'd waited. I took the box and scurried off for the fire escape.
Diving ports and kettle drums, swallowtail coats, tablecloths, and patent leather shoes, and bathing suits and bowling balls, and clarinets and rings. This radio really needs is a fuse. A tinker, a tailor, a soldier's things, his rifle, his boots, full of rocks. Oh, and this one. This one is for me, and everything's a dollar in this box. Cufflinks and hubcaps, and trophies and paperbacks. Good transportation, but the brakes aren't so hot. Neckties and boxing gloves. This jackknife is rusted. You can pound that dent out on the hood. A tinker. Soldier's things, his rifle, his boots, full of rocks. Oh, and this one is for bravery. Oh, and this one is for me. And everything's a dollar in.
Once home, I realized I was worse for wear. I was shiveringly cold and miserable from exposure. I ran a hot bath and was deeply bothered by my inability to dive headfirst into the Penbenny notebooks. But I had them, and at that moment, I could think of no better prize in the world. After a while of laying in the bath, reconstituting, I could stand it no more and pulled the first notebook from the box. On the first page was the simple, spectacular title, Nancy Drew and the Case of the Slippery Spider, by Bert Penbenny. I turned the page and read aloud. "Boy, I'd do anything to get rid of these spiders," said Officer George Gowdy as he looked up the mine shaft. "Sure would make our job easier," said his brown-haired assistant, George Cloudy. They had been trapped in the mine now for 3 days without food or water. I moved to the next notebook, simply to get a deeper general sense. Its title page read, Nancy Drew and the Case of the Cold Crackers, by Caledonia Penbenny. After my supper, I read through the night, looking like Nancy Drew herself, pencil and notebook at my side, searching for some piece of evidence that could string this all together. Some of the clues I wrote down include the fact that the name Nancy Drew was misspelled in each of the titles of the three notebooks. As though trying to avoid copyright, the last name of the girl detective was spelt D-R-U. In addition, the girl herself made no appearance in any of the volumes, nor was there much in the way of any murder mystery, nor anything being purloined. Instead, the three main characters, Officer George Gowdy, Officer George Cloudy, and Officer George Coldy, would try to escape from some room or another in which they'd been strangely imprisoned. In The Case of the Slippery Spider, the three officers were trapped in a mine full of spiders. In The Case of Cold Crackers, they had been locked in a pantry. In Freddie Penbenny's volume, Nancy Drew and the Case of the Formed Frame, the officers found themselves trapped between the inner and outer walls of a castle. In addition, after their first introduction, the officers became less formal with each other, and for the rest of the narrative, referred to each other as uncle or aunt, as the next strange twist was that two of the officers were, despite being named George, female. But for these striking particulars, the books were not badly written, nor unenjoyable, and the following day, after gently repositioning the glass box full of notebooks on the ledge outside the Penbenny window, I went to the library to investigate the real Nancy Drew books. I had never read either these or the Hardy Boys, but I felt somewhat familiar with the genre as bicultural absorption. I was not really surprised to find the Penbenny volumes hitting very close to their mark, if not in substance, then at least in the quality of the writing, flow of prose, ratio of dialogue to exposition, and levels of tension. I recovered my camcorder that afternoon as well. The battery, as usual, was dead, and the 2-hour cassette had run to the end of its spool. As I rewound the tape, I listened to the telltale mouse squeaking of voices spiking on the rewinding timeline. My mood and involvement with the Penbennies had palpably shifted because of the Nancy Drew stories. In a sort of joking way, I had written an ironic imitation in the title of my clue-keeping notebook, Nancy Drew and the Case of the Glass Box Notebooks, by Show and Sleeves. I was definitely inclining toward detective work of the Nancy Drew variety. There was a mystery here, and I would try to crack it. So I sat and listened to the tape with a pencil, intent on writing down whatever I could glean, names or numbers, or anything that seemed important from their talk. At the end of the 2-hour listen, I sat in stony silence. I had written 3 words down, uncle, aunt, and aunt again. Bert addressed the two ladies as aunt, and they addressed him as uncle. They said no other words but these, and yet they used them quite often. There was tone in their voice, in the way they said uncle or aunt, sometimes questioning, sometimes with light shock. When it came time for dinner, Caldonia said, "Uncle," in such a way that I understood her to mean, "Please take out the chicken and start the oven." I wondered if the Penmeny conservation could have extended to such a tight limit on the use of the spoken word. I could not think long, however, on this, as my stony silence was interrupted by their triplicate arrival in the hall. I ran to my door, not knowing what I might do. As Bert's hand twisted the knob on their apartment door, I opened mine. They each gave me a light glance, but then focused again on their entrance. Bert pushed the door in, politely standing back for Freddy and Caldonia to enter. He glanced at me again as he waited for the two women to pass. In some desperation, I heard my voice call out, "Uncle!" Freddy and Caldonia turned to face me. Bert stepped closer. "Aunt," I said to Freddy. "Aunt," I said again, this time to Caldonia. Bert glanced at the objects in my hand. My notebook full of clues. My pencil. "Uncle," Bert nodded, acknowledging me. "Uncle," Freddy and Caldonia said. They turned and continued on their way into the apartment. Bert tipped his head, and I entered. I took up my position at the table, and I set to work on my first book. It already had its title, Nancy Drew and the Case of the Glass Box Notebooks, in which Officer George Gowdy, Officer George Cloudy, and Officer George Coldy were joined by Officer George Golden. These four, who found themselves trapped in a small kitchen with a glass box which contained four notebooks, that for me now were of the highest possible mystery.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void. Thank you.